You're listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss.
Welcome to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Today we've got a good one for you. We kind of put two shows together. We had this idea of first a petty preferences show, which is just things, tabs and spaces and whatnot. And we'll talk about all of that. But then there's also like a lot of stuff, which is like, I actually prefer function definitions over an arrow function in a variable. And there's some real reasoning behind that. So Scott and I are going to go through a list of probably 20 different things. And we're going to say what we prefer, and as well as like why we prefer that, which is generally you try to side with more readable code over being a hotshot. So we are sponsored by three awesome companies today: Linode, Cloud Computing Developers Trust, LogRocket, JavaScript Session Replay, and FreshBooks Cloud Accounting. We'll talk about all of them partway through the episode. How are you doing today, Scott?
I'm doing good. Just hanging out, launching our site this week. I'm just in berserker mode here. Just, you know, we have a friend of mine doing Q&A for us. Is it Q&A or QA?
Q&A. Quality. Oh, you know. No, QA. You're right. Yeah. Q&A is questions and answers.
I know. I always say Q&A. And then just as I was about to say that, I was like, wait a second. It might not actually be Q&A. We have a friend of mine doing QA for us. And it's simultaneously really great to just have somebody go through and find all these things. But like, it's also super depressing to see so many things pop up after you're feeling like, all right, I'm ready to go.
Yeah,
and then
yeah,
your to-do list has gotten down to like four more things left. And then now it's populated like crazy again. So
totally. Yeah. I much prefer those, like a person that you've asked to do it, than someone like being like, hey, like, what's up with this, tweeting a screenshot or whatever. That always happens. It's like, I work like 8 months to launch a course. And then like the first reply is, I think it's broken. And there's like something like weird.
Oh yeah, I know, it's so hard to find everything, you know, especially on a large project. So yeah, that's where I'm at. If I sound exhausted, I'm a little exhausted, I gotta say. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get on into it. First one is function definition. There's many ways to define a function in JavaScript. Probably the two most popular ones are if you're just defining like a top level function, not a method or ever. Do you do what's called a named function? You write the word function and then the name of it, open up parentheses, open up curly brackets. Or do you do const or var or let, the name of the function is equal to, and you do a little arrow function inside of that. I am on team. There's certainly arrow functions have their use, and I'm not poo-pooing them at all. I use them all day long, but when you are defining a regular ass function, I always prefer the first, which is a named function, over sticking it in a variable. I've never felt good about that. What about you?
Yeah, I'm pretty much the same way. However, I will say that I'm exactly the same way. However, there has been a recent kind of thing that's popped up in my code base, which I wonder if you've noticed this. So in TypeScript, you can define the inputs, the outputs, like everything about a function as a type, and then assign it to the function much more easily using the const do something way. Even if you're not using an arrow function, if you're saying const do something is equal to function do something, you can, like, if you're assigning a function to a variable, then you can type that entire function's inputs and outputs
in a single type.
One go. Yeah.
Yeah.
Rather than doing them separately, which it can be advantageous to do that. And also, I found it weird that you can do that with function definitions, the first type of function definition. You can do that using JS doc style types, but you can't do it with normal TypeScript types.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I've never thought about that.
Yeah, it's a little weird. But yeah, it's one of those things.
Yeah. Yeah. Then I'm trying to think like what would be the downsides to doing it that way? I guess you couldn't do function overloading, which is probably not something you're using every single day, but
yeah.
If you want to, function overloading in TypeScript is where you define multiple signatures to your function. So you say, all right, this function could take in a number, or it could take in a string and a Boolean value. You know, like there's two different implementations of this function, and all the logic is contained inside of it. And based on what they pass, we will do different things to them.
Yeah. So typically, typically doing the function.
Well, the other thing I was going to say. Sometimes people say, named functions are better because putting an arrow function in a variable, that's technically an anonymous function. And it used to be the fact that debugging anonymous function was hard. They were anonymous, but all dev tools can infer the function name from the variable. So that's not a thing anymore.
Yeah, it is funny. I have had that issue. I will say, though, if I am having a callback function 100% of the time, I am using just a straight up arrow function in that callback and an anonymous arrow function. I know this is not really the same question, but in use cases where you could just use a function as well, I'm using an anonymous arrow function always in callbacks, just because I like the syntax a little bit more. It to me, it's cleaner. I know what it's doing. It could be a little bit mysterious, especially when you get into like multiple callback layers deep. If we're talking about being a hotshot here, I think sometimes people do that where they have a callback that calls a callback that calls a callback, and you're just like, whoa, what is going on here? Sometimes I might break those up into individual functions, but that's its own argument, I guess. Next up here is going to be file paths aliases. So whether or not you have an alias for a directory where you can then access that file via the alias and then the file path, making it sort of an absolute path versus using the dot dot or traversal, like file system traversal, to relatively look up a file, specifically done in imports or loading images or any sort of things like that. I personally am always using the aliases because it's almost always cleaner to me in the ability to see what's an alias or like exactly where something's living. And specifically, you know, I'll define my aliases with a dollar sign in front of them. So $DB/whatever. Everything in $DB is going to be a database method. Everything in $elements is going to be one of my root elements. Everything in $graphics is going to be images. So that's kind of how I do my file systems rather than working with relative paths.
Yeah. After we talked about this last time, I think I've had a change of heart on it. I think that maybe this is the way to go, especially I'm starting to see this concept of import maps being more popular. An import map is essentially because not everything will soon be in NPM. Sometimes stuff comes from the network. Sometimes stuff is in a workspace. Like you have an NPM workspace, and sometimes stuff is in a URL. They're all over the place. And if you want to have the nice, like, import something from utils, if you want to have that, even though your utils are local, then you can use an import map for it. So it looks like there is a proposal on how to do it in JavaScript. Dino supports it. So maybe that's the way to do it. We'll have to do like a little hasty on what import maps are just to go a little bit deeper into them. But
yeah, because I've always just used, you know, TypeScript aliases or Vite aliases or whatever. I've never dove into the world of import maps, despite the fact that it's related to something I love.
Yeah, I think the import spec in Dino is the same as, I have this one from the WICG, which is the web incubator. What's the CG stand for?
Committee group?
Committee group. Committee. That's it. Yeah.
It looks committee group?
Probably. Let's just say it is. Community group.
That's it. Yeah. Committee and group kind of mean the same thing in some way. So that would have been.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. So, all right, we'll go more into that. Next one is implicit versus explicit return. When we had arrow functions added to JavaScript, we added the ability to implicitly return, which means that whatever is after the arrow function without curly curly brackets to denote a block, you can just return what you have there. And then you have implicit return, or sorry, explicit return, which is just using the return keyword. And I don't think that you should have, I don't have any rules around these other than I kind of think if it's a one-liner, I use implicit all the time. For map, filter, reduce, I use these types of things. Mm-hmm. If it goes more than one line, then I much prefer the return. I remember a couple of years ago, everybody was implicitly returning React components, and they were the hugest pain in the butt to debug because you couldn't stick a console log in there, or you couldn't like make a quick variable before it because there was no block. The first thing to happen in the function was the return statement. And there was tricks of console log or and whatnot. But if it is more than one or two lines, I go explicit all day long.
Yeah, I know. This is one of those ones where I would love to say explicit every single time because, like you mentioned, it does make debugging or adding on to if things need to change, you need to augment that data. It makes augmenting and working with that function way easier if you just say explicit all the time, 100%. But in reality and in practice, I do find myself with the exact same rule set that you have, where it is, if it's a one-liner, I almost always use the implicit return and otherwise obviously do explicit. But yeah, it's one of those ones where I understand the benefits of always doing explicit returns. And if you're out there and you're thinking, yeah, I choose the non-hotshot approach of using explicit all the time, because to me, that's the non-hotshot approach. That's the practical approach of always using explicit. I get that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I just can't bring myself to do it. I don't know. I don't know what it is. There's something about that implicit return for one-liners that's really sweet sometimes, especially maps. Yeah.
You're just doing something. Yeah, especially maps. You do just doing something in it. Maybe there's like a rule to have around implicitly returning an object, because if you want to implicitly return an object, you need parentheses and then you put the curly brackets inside of that. And then that kind of looks like a function block and whatnot. Somebody tweeted, we asked on Twitter, like, what are your rules around this? And his name is Cosme Escobedo. He says, I feel like if a trick is common enough for me and my teammates to parse quickly enough without having to think about, fine, then I will use it. Otherwise, I will use the most straightforward option. I think that's really important, is if your entire team understands how these things work, it's probably fine, right? But Scott and I have literally all kinds of developers from around the world who may or may not understand these things. I have to think about that, where it's like, I don't want to create an unintentional tripping hazard for somebody when they're just trying to learn some JavaScript.
But also in my own code base, you know, there's only a couple of people working in it. We're not a large team. So like, there's no one necessarily to check me, or, you know, we have code styles, we have ESLint roles and whatever. And I guess ESLint and Prettier are the things that will check me on some of the code styles. But like, sometimes you got to like really strongly declare what these code styles are going to be in a code style wiki or something about your code base. Otherwise,
yeah,
you'll just find yourself, you know, maybe bending your rules here or there. Next thing you know, there are no rules. It's free for all. Do whatever you want.
Yeah. Tools over rules is the saying. Have something else enforce it rather than yourself.
Totally. Tools over rules. It's wonderful. Next up is array.reduce versus literally anything else, which I thought that was a very funny way that you decided to put this in the docs, because reduce is one of those functions that can get unreadable pretty quickly, especially if people are not super experienced with reduce. I can't necessarily put my finger on what it is about reduce, but it is so hard to add a glance, look at a complex reduce and be like, all right, I get what's going on here. But in the same regard, reduce is super handy anytime you have a collection of data and you need to derive some other data from it. Reduce all day. I mean, like for me personally, I think reduce is one of those situations where it's so handy to use reduce that you need to say, listen, we got to spend some time really honing our reduce skills. we have to do reduce examples. We have to say, all right, what, you know, what's a good opportunity to use reduce? Okay, you have a shopping cart full of a bunch of products. I want to reduce this down to get a total or something, right? Those types of things, those types of small examples that you could do other ways, but you can really get into it with reduce, get that experience under your belt. Me personally, the usefulness outweighs the difficulty of readiness of it. So I would say I will take the hotshot way of using reduce over other methods, loops and who knows what.
Yeah, I am on team. I love reduce and I will use reduce where it makes sense. But if there is obviously another function that does something like that, because JavaScript is adding new array methods all the time, then clearly use that. I think where the one or the other comes in with me is, should I use multiple map filter reduce functions and just chain them all together? Or should I use a single reduce all in one go? And I often opt for doing multiple map filter reduce chains. I find them easier to debug. I find them a little bit more readable over doing it all in one go on reduce. And anytime I post code like that, people are like, you know, you can do that in a single function. And I say, obviously, I know that, but I think sometimes it's a bit more readable to just chain them. There's obviously perf. If I'm doing one thing, like what's the numbers there? If I'm looping over 300,000 database records and trying to figure out how many blue cars have been sold, then of course that's probably a really good use for reduce. But In most cases, it probably doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's funny. I've been getting really into like MongoDB aggregations. I was doing a lot of that in JavaScript, right? Like I would pull the data and then I would do the JavaScript to transform the data how I wanted it to. And like more recently, I've been doing really complex aggregations. And it's not the same thing, but it feels like the same thing where I know this code is kind of painful to look at. And I know this code is kind of obnoxious. But at the end of the day, the perf implications of using these aggregation functions rather than using JavaScript to do it is a net gain by enough that I need to do it. Yeah.
I took a 20-second map filter reduce down to 100 milliseconds by moving it to MongoDB aggregations. It's unreal.
Yeah.
Next one is using a for in, for of loop. No, we're not talking about the for I plus plus. Everybody hates that one. that for I equals zero, I plus plus, there's the only use case I ever will use that is when I am looping over multiple values at once. Most commonly is if you have a pixel set from a canvas and you need to loop over every 4 pixels at a time. That's the best use case because you get R, G, B, alpha, R, G, B, alpha. And you want to loop over all 4 at once. And it doesn't make sense to group them by 4 beforehand because it's literally millions and millions of pixels in there. So we're talking about the for of and for in methods, for const person in people, and versus using people.map, people.forEach, probably not map, because map has a use case. Literally, if you just need to loop over everything, is the .forEach method better or the for loop better? I will opt for using the .forEach method on the array because usually I'm doing other stuff. I'm mapping, reducing, filtering, finding inside of it already. But when it comes to doing async await, I will always move it over to a for loop because the big benefit of a for loop is you can await. You can pause a loop from running inside of it. What about you?
Yeah. For me, it's not something I like don't do, but I have a weird aversion. I have a weird aversion to having a variable defined outside of a loop and then updating that variable inside of the loop.
Yeah. If you're doing that, then you need to be using map.
Yeah. Well, so for me, like I'm almost always, I mean, this will go around the next one we talk about, but I'm almost always creating a new variable based on whatever I'm doing outside of my map. So I tend to not use even just loops overall. I'm almost always, I know that's a hot topic on Twitter where people are like, why are you doing all this crazy map reduce stuff when you could just do a normal loop? But for me, I almost never opt for the normal loop. And I don't know if it's just how my brain works, but
yeah,
it never feels right to me to do that, even though I know it's an extremely common technique. Yeah. And oftentimes it can be way more readable. I get that. But for me, it feels like I like to define a thing as a thing. And then if I have a new thing. And I don't know, the loop where you're just like looping over and inserting something into an existing array or something or an existing variable always feels weird to me, even though I know it's not. I can't explain
it. It's not. I agree with you. I think if you are trying to add data to an existing data structure, that's what your map filter reduce are for. But if you need to, for example, if I need to, I have a list of three people and I need to go fetch their or go hit their GitHub profiles or something like that. Then that's not a good example because you should probably do that all at once, right? If you just need to literally stop and wait for something inside of it, I think that's your best case. I think also the for loop's got a bad rap with var because var variables would leak outside of for loops because we didn't have block scope. But let and const, they are block scoped. And I think there's a lot of holdover from people. It used to be a rule, don't use for loops. They're awful. Functional programming till death. Whereas like it's good. It's a good life, folks. Let me tell you.
I have such a hard time with that. I don't know. I have like an async for each and I have like async for each in my
like a function
that I use.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like that's what I prefer to use for some reason over a for loop. I can't tell you why. I can't put my finger on it.
Do it. Try it. You're going to be, it's freeing. It feels good.
I know.
The world is a better place.
Sometimes we fall into patterns that you just get so used to and then it's hard to break out of those patterns, right?
Yeah.
You know, you just get so comfortable doing the things the way you're doing them.
I think it's, the important part is that like people ask me this all the time, why didn't you use this? And sometimes my answer is, I don't know. I don't know. I picked it or I didn't even think about doing it that way. Or I've just always done it this way. And you just got to not be like, well, this is better because of perf or whatever. It's like, oh, maybe I should be using that. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm totally open to the fact that I could be totally wrong. I think it's an important thing to always be reevaluating if the things you're doing are doing, if you're only doing it because you've walked that path and ingrained it into your brain is just doing it that way. Like if it's actually easier to read, better, nicer, faster, or stronger, whatever. But if we're talking about better, faster, stronger, whatever, and you're looking at hosting your site somewhere, I mean, can you get any better, faster, stronger than Linode? I don't know, Wes. What do you think?
I don't think so. Linode is the better, faster, stronger cloud computing that developers trust. That is the totally not blessed saying that we have for them. Linode has fantastic cloud computing. They've got Linux boxes where you can put everything that you need to do, whether you need high memory or high CPU, whatever it is you're working on. Most likely you are trying to host a server-side application and you need to put that somewhere. And Linode is a fantastic place to run that. You're going to want to check it out for your next project. Linode.com/syntax. That's going to get you $100 in free credit. Thank you, Linode, for sponsoring.
Sick. All right. Next up is updating versus creating a new variable. There's a school of thought, and it's largely like functional programming stuff, where you're always creating a new variable all the time. And one thing for me, I don't think it's just a functional style of programming, but I think it really came into focus for me when I got further into both testing and TypeScript, where creating a new variable every single time you're doing anything, to me, is way easier to test and is way easier to type because updating and changing things and whatever, if the data is changing, the structure changing or anything, or, you know, I used to think that one of the coolest parts about JavaScript was, oh, I have a variable. It's a string. I can turn this string into a number. And now I hate that. I'm like, why would you want to be unsure of the type of this thing? This thing is a string or a number or this or that. You know, I've like kind of fallen into the role of an actual programmer who, you know, a thing is the thing that it is, and it can only ever be that thing. You cannot change its type. So if it needs to change its type or it needs to change its structure or anything, it's now an entirely new thing. What do you think about that, Wes?
Yeah, I agree as well. I'm not hard and fast by it. I do see a lot of developers sort of having the mindset of never, like, always use const 100% of the time. And my rule is, yeah, by default, use const. And then if you need a new variable, then create it. But sometimes you do just want to literally override it. You have a score variable, and the score variable needs to be updated. What am I going to do? Make a new score 2 variable, and then the next time I need it is score 3? You know, like, no, just update the existing one. But in most cases, you don't want to be mutating the old data, especially with like event loop and browser or like node ticks and things like that. So I agree with you. Variables are free. You're not running up a bunch of memory by creating a new variable to store your React component in. So I think that you should create a new one by default. The amount of times that I've accidentally overwritten something and didn't mean to, and then it's come back to bite you a little bit in the past. The most simple example is the mutation-based array methods, reverse, sort, and splice. And you go, oh, shoot, I called reverse on that, but now it actually reversed the original array. I only want the new version of it, you know? So I much prefer making a new variable. By the way, there is a new proposal of 4 new array methods: 2 reversed, 2 sorted, 2 spliced, and with.
Really?
And those are all the non-mutating equivalents to their sorts: reverse, sort, split, splice. So I have a little TikTok coming up on those.
You do. That's cool. It's always a massive bummer when, like, you hit something and you're like, the only, you know, helper here that exists mutates the array. Okay.
Yeah.
I guess I gotta mutate this array. But you know, one thing that I found to be, when you are every single time creating a new variable, and like you said, there is a school of thought to always use const. And I gotta say, that's pretty much the school that I'm living in. I don't necessarily have it as a hard and fast, like I cannot change this rule, but yeah, I'm gonna prefer const every time. And something that happens when you say, I'm always going to create a new variable and it's always going to be a const, is that you end up getting actually good at naming things, because the thing's names end up becoming really descriptive. This is like...
Good point.
Yeah. Tutorials list F, you know, with SKUs. Tutorials list with populated, whatever. And you end up, like you said, variables are free. But not only are variables free, I used to get really terse with my variable names. So short variable names, you got to keep it like, I thought that was easy to read. And it turns out that's the kind of hotshot way of doing it, right? I don't know, it's just these tiny little variable names that are who knows what, but who knows what they actually are. And I've since moved to a world where I got some long ass variable names now. And I got to say, I like it a lot.
That's true.
You kind of know what everything is a little bit more. More variables, longer variable names. You know, I'm a fast typer. I can type these things. But not only that, my IDE kind of just populates it all for me anyways nowadays. So it doesn't necessarily bug me running long.
That's a good point. The tooling has gotten so good that you have it. And also like...
So fast, yeah.
Like TypeScript has also made you think like ahead of time. All right, what's going to be in this variable? You can't just start adding stuff as you need it. And like, oh, well, at this point, I need SKUs, like you said. I'm just going to add them into the variable. And then you have another function. You're like, does this data have SKUs or not? You know?
Right.
Yeah. Good points. I really like that.
Yeah. It's a change to me. It made me feel like a more mature developer. And it's funny that it's the type of thing that someone coming from any other real language, non-JavaScript language, would probably just be like, yeah, of course. What are you talking about? You sound like a JavaScript developer. But I'm growing up as a programmer somehow.
I saw a Reddit thread the other day where someone says, my like computer science teacher is telling us to use one-letter variables because it saves space and is more readable. And everyone's like, what? Like, if you really need shorter variable names, which, by the way, is almost never an issue because of GZIP. You ship the variable name.
Yeah.
List of level up tutorials, products with SKUs. You ship that 100 times, GZIP only ships it once, right? And you can minify your code so that your shipped code is just L instead of that long variable.
That's not for me to do. I'm to read the code, read and write the code. I'm not.
You're the human, not the robot.
Correct. Yeah.
Except on the dance floor, then you're the robot.
Did you know my dance crew is called Robotops,
like really?
RoboCop? But yeah, yeah. Our crew we named. In typical college fashion, we were watching RoboCop one night and we're like, oh, Robotops, that's cool. You know, so we were the Robotops crew. And we are the Robotops crew.
That's awesome. Next one we have here is converting a iterable or array-like to a real array. So there are certain things in JavaScript that can be looped over, but do not have all of the array methods that you know and love. Probably the most common example is query selector all. You select all the spans on a page. You want to loop over them. You can use dot for each on that, but you cannot use map, filter, find, all of those reduce that you know and love. So the solution is you turn it into an array. And the two most common ways to turn an iterable into an array is you create an array literal, square brackets, and then use the dot, 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 name of the array or name of the iterable, and that will spread every item into the new array. And then the other way is using array.from, and you pass it your actual variable. I have probably used both of these equally over my career, and I always find, I find myself in my tutorials citing more on array.from versus the dot, dot, dot. The dot, dot, dot looks so cool, but I ask myself, is that the hot shot way? Whereas like array.from literally says what it does. What do you think?
I don't know. To me, you say you've done these about equally, or you choose to use array.from. I'm going to say I pretty much, like, since spread came into existence.
Yeah.
If I need to create a new object or if I need to create a new array, I mean, I'm spreading. They call me margarine. I'm spreading, man. I almost always spread. And I can't think of too many instances in which I use array.from over spread ever. I don't know what it is about the spread syntax. I've gotten so accustomed to reading it that it doesn't feel like the hotshot way.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just it to me, is it doesn't feel like I'm doing a trick. It feels like that's how to do it.
You know what it does. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think to me, it's just I've gotten so comfortable with the spread that I don't even put any second thought to it. And, whether it is destructuring and what is it called, spreading when you're like the rest, dot, 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 rest?
Yeah.
Is that still spreading?
Spread is when you put things into something, and rest is where you collect them into an array. So it's the opposite.
You call it rest. You call it rest. Okay. I wasn't sure if they were both called spread or if one was spread and one was rest. I mean, I use spread. I use rest. I love that stuff. Those three dots, some of my best friends in JavaScript.
It's true. Like I do know what it is. And also the benefit to using a spread is that if you need to combine two arrays, or like most commonly is if you want to create a new version of that array, like we just talked about, you're creating a new variable instead of pushing it into the existing array, you can just spread it into array and then put the thing that you want either at the front or the end of that array just as a variable or as an explicit object, which you cannot do in array.from. So
one of my favorite things of spreading an object, and I know we're not talking about objects here, but one of my favorite things with object spreading is that specifically like overriding properties where I can say, give me all of the contents from the previous array, and then any value that you put below the spread will override a property that exists in the previous data. And to me, that's such a useful technique to say, all right, just give me everything. And if any of these things are updated or changed, it will just override it and I don't have to think about it. So I don't know. I really like spreading. I know this is an array spread versus whatever, but so you might be looking at your array.spread and wondering, how this is working, but you won't be wondering how your website is working if you use LogRocket. That's at logrocket.com/syntax. LogRocket is the perfect service to really stop guessing what your users are experiencing on your website. Whether that is heat maps and conversions, being able to understand what exactly your users are doing. Are they clicking on that thing that looks like a button but isn't a button? And therefore, they're getting confused. User has experienced confused and hurt itself. But no, you can use LogRocket and see, hey, they're clicking on this thing that's not really a button. Or perhaps they're doing the one thing that you didn't want them to do and it's breaking the site. And you can see that with their video session replay. So you get access to error tracking and issue management. You get access to some cool machine learning where you can stop missing the important stuff and get access to exactly what's happening at any given time. You get user experience analytics, heat maps, front-end performance monitoring, and the session replay is really the crown jewel of these tools because you can see exactly what's happening, when it's happening, and how it's happening with this a video scrubbable replay, giving you access to really dive in to errors or issues or even nice experiences that are happening on your website. You get access to the console log, network request, error logs, and more. So check it out at logrocket.com/syntax. Sign up and get 14 days for free. Yeah, next up we have destructuring an object to access its individual properties versus using those properties via the object's name dot the property. I almost always opt for destructuring if I know the data is going to be there. It's always frustrating when you have a destructuring situation and the error that comes up, it says, you know, cannot, I don't forget what the error is exactly, but you know, you cannot find the variable that you're trying to destructure because the parent is undefined. And if the parent is undefined, destructuring will break your code there. So in that's the situation where it makes more sense to use something like optional chaining and object.property syntax. But for the most part, when I'm working with objects, I'm trying to always work in a situation where I know that object is going to have the properties that I'm expecting it to have in it. And that's something that has been a shift for me. Because, you know, I don't know if you've worked in some data libraries or you think like Apollo, right? Or something like that, right?
Yeah.
Where you hit the data, you wait for the data to return. And before the data returns, that data property is null. So then you have to check, is data dot whatever actually existing? And it's not existing by default. So for me personally, I've really tried to move everything in my code base into a way where the property is going to at least be there so that I can destructure things and access it. Because it is more readable for me to see tutorials rather than data.tutorials. I don't know. Yeah. Yeah. It's a big thing or what, but yeah.
So much better to use destructuring when you have a variable that needs to be used multiple times. If you have like tutorial and you have videos, an array, length, which is a number, and a couple other properties, having to write tutorial dot for every single one just clutters up the UI, where it's nice to have a nice clean variable videos, you know, especially if you need to use it multiple times over. So I much prefer destructuring. A lot of this stuff, when it first came out, everybody goes, what about readability? And a lot of that has died down because we just learned what they do. And it's just, I think that's part of being a programmer, is there's obviously lots of hotshot stuff. Like we'll talk about the spread, but also you could just learn what the spread does and then use it, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Like we had to learn what plus was in grade three. We don't literally write out plus. We put a plus sign in there.
It's amazing. Symbols, man. Symbols can stand in the way for concepts.
Yeah. Next one is destructuring an array versus reference by index. I'm not sure if this one is hotly contested or not, but if I need to grab, and this is not all that often, but I find myself doing it a lot when I do splits on like you have a comma separated list of data and you split it on the comma, or you are doing a for each over a value, and you get an array of the key is the first one and the value is the second one. Mm. I much prefer to destructure those into proper variables instead of using square bracket 0 and square bracket 1.
Yeah, I do too, but I almost try to not use this very much at all. Like I almost always prefer an object structure to an array structure where things are different, you know? Like in an array structure for me, I like it if every single thing is the exact same thing. So like if you were to say destructure one value out to a variable, another value out to a variable, you're creating those variable names while you're destructuring it. And it's like those are now becoming two new things where like I really prefer to have things defined as like what they are somewhere. And I don't know if that's a deficiency of mine or whatever, but I almost never use destructuring arrays into variables, especially since leaving React land. I think that's something that you used a lot in React to, you know, use set state. You know, the first one that comes out is the variable. The next one that comes out is the updater function. That is this technique. And that's why you can name your use state returns to be whatever you want to name them.
Yeah, that is nice, though, because if it was an object, nice you'd have to destructure data and then rename it immediately into whatever it is. And you get rid of all of that renaming cruft because you can literally name the first thing whatever you want because you're referencing it by index.
Yeah, totally. And in that context, like that tracks a lot for me. But I almost never use it in my own code base for some reason. It just never feels right to me for some reason.
Yeah, it's probably just because you don't have a whole lot of data where the thing is based on its index. The thing should be based on its name, right?
Totally. Next up here is the number function wrapping around a string versus plus string to turn it into a number. Basically, how do you turn a string into a number? I use parse int or parse float for everything.
I didn't even know that this was a thing. So if
I know
you
I'm reading this, I'm like, where's parse in this?
So if you have a string that is a number, and you put a plus in front of that string, then that will turn it into a number versus being more explicit and wrapping it in number. I think the benefit to using number or this plus method is that you don't have to pick if it has a decimal or not because it will just parse it regardless. In the parse example, you have to pick parse float or parse int, which in most cases you should probably know that.
Yeah.
It depends. Like if you're, let's say you're pulling the weather in from an API and you're, do you know it's going to be 20? I guess if you do know, it might have a decimal.
You're right. You don't always know.
Then you do know if it might have a decimal.
But you don't always know.
Yeah.
You would probably figure
it
out.
But I think the plus trick, I literally have never used that in my entire career. Have you?
Never heard of it.
No.
Didn't know it existed.
I never even heard of it. Yeah. So, that's crazy. But passing it to capital N number parentheses, so use the number constructor in JavaScript.
It's way more readable.
Way more readable. And we actually have a couple more. We have one more on Booleans coming up that is similar to this.
Yeah. So I don't know why you would use the plus string unless you were just being cheeky.
It's hush shot. Like, you're hush shot.
Yeah.
That's why.
That's the hush shot technique I don't need. Yeah.
Next, we have incrementing values. And so I have an ESLint rule, and this was not by choice, but it was just by adopting Airbnb's ESLint rules, is that if you need to increment a value, instead of using val plus plus or val plus equals one, those are short form for saying val equals val plus one. And my ESLint rule says never do a hotshot one-liner, especially with the plus plus in front versus behind, where you have to know, is it incremented first and then returned, or is it returned and then incremented? You know, like, come on, you shouldn't be doing that. So I prefer the much more explicit variable equals the existing variable plus one.
Yeah, I agree. This is one of those ones that got turned down for me with the Airbnb rules, and I've never thought about it since. Because honestly, val equals val plus one or new val equals val plus one, whatever you're doing with that, to me, it is so much more readable. Granted, val plus plus, I get what's happening there. That's like they teach you that in the first JavaScript loop class you ever take.
Bottles of beer on the wall, yeah.
Yeah, it's not exactly a hard or a foreign technique or an unreadable technique, but I do just find it to be more explicit the other way and do largely prefer it for some reason. I can't quite put my finger on it. It's a feeling for me.
Yeah.
So you had a tweet asking, you know, what people were wondering, and one of the responses was using, oh, wow.
The fact that you can't read this proves my point. I'm so glad.
I know. I'm just looking at it. So they say if, and then a parentheses, exclamation point, and then two
another
conditionals.
Another pair of parentheses.
Yeah. And inside of that, two conditionals with an and between them. Instead of if not foo or not bar. Both of those stink for me. And it's like when you get into or not, and
it's
is,
over.
Or it's over. What I end up doing, I end up just doing nested if statements at that point because
oh,
it's so
point.
Much more readable. So if I'm getting into multiple ors and ands and using positives and negatives, truthy, falsy in there, man, I'm splitting those up into multiple ifs because for me, and again, an if statement is fairly, it's free, right? It does give you some lines of code, but you can comment that sucker. You can put breaks in there. You can, you know, really, really fine tune it out instead of trying to be fancy and just jam everything into one conditional.
Totally. I've done these one-liners of checking for three things and two of them have to be true and one has to be false.
Yes.
And then you
some
come
of the buggiest
back
code
like 6
I've
months later,
written.
Like, what?
Yeah.
And you're just trying to like, if this is not and this is plus and another set of parentheses, this is not. And you're like, what is going? I much prefer if you can bust it up into a couple nested if statements. People, it's more code, but who cares? It's so much more
who
readable.
Cares?
Throw a couple comments in there. Save yourself.
Yeah. I think that the code of mine that I've written that ends up failing the most is when you're trying to get too fancy with your if statements because
and
you think
that,
your brain thinks at the point you're writing it, all right, this makes sense. And then it stops working or it's not working. And you come back to it and you're like, oh, wait, I didn't goof this one up. It should be and is versus and not is. Oh, okay. You know
where that code is often written the most is in like mission critical permission systems.
Oh, yeah. Permission systems.
The last spot you should be doing that.
And David Capiano is going to chime in here about state machines being the solution here for a lot of this stuff because, you know, you shouldn't be checking all these things. You should be checking, like, what is the state that you're currently in, you know?
Exactly. Next one also has to do with if statements. Multiple if statements versus a switch statement versus multi-line. This is another word I can't say. Ternary. There's like 8 syllables in there, isn't there?
Ternary.
So
ternary. I don't know if it's ternary or ternary or if that even matters at all.
Turnsky. We'll call it a turnsky. So multiple if statements versus a switch statement versus a turnsky. I am team in there. If I have like what's like called an enum in TypeScript, where it's a list of very clear possible options, I might opt for a switch, but almost always I will opt for multiple if statements. Even with like an if else, I'll sometimes just prefer single if statements with returns inside of them because I think. What about you?
I like using else and if statements quite a bit, and I almost will never reach for a switch, but there are times when I do, like you said, I have a list of things. These are the only possible ones it can be. Typically it makes sense to me if I have like more than 3 or so things it could be, right? If it could be, here's the 10 different icons I have. It can be any one of these icons. I'll do a switch over those 10 icons to be whatever the return should be. Like that's what we do for our icon component in Svelte. I almost only do the turnsky if it's a one-liner.
Yep.
And ever since leaving React Land, I don't do turnskies in my template code anymore because I don't have to do that in JS. And in the Svelte type language, I don't have to do that. So you know, the JSX style ternary in your templating language. To me, it made sense in React land. I don't have to do it anymore, and I'm glad that I don't. But for the most part, yeah, I'll use ternaries if it's a one-liner. I'll use a switch case if I got like 10 different options it can be. But for the 90% of the time, I'm using ifs and if-else more so than multiple if statements even.
One kind of neat thing about a switch is I had a tip I posted on Twitter about using never in TypeScript and basically for what's called exhaustive checking, meaning that TypeScript will make sure that you handle every single use case. Like you say, all right, I have three currencies, Canadian, US, and Euro. And TypeScript will make sure that you've handled every single case. And if a new currency is added to the list, then you have a type error. And it turns out that you don't need to use the never in a switch statement because TypeScript will exhaustive check your code with a switch statement by default, which is kind of cool, but you can also just make it work with an if statement by using never. So I thought that was kind of a nifty use case of a switch statement.
Exhaustive checking. Is that my bank account when I'm trying to pay my mortgage?
That's actually pretty good.
Cool. Next one is around like promises and error catching. You know, sometimes you just wrap everything in a try catch, right? You have your try block, you have your catch block in case something goes wrong, you handle your issues. And other times I find it just really easy to use just straight up a wait on a promise and just toss the dot catch on that bad boy, right? Because the dot catch will catch any errors that happen. And if there's an error, you catch it in the catch. Otherwise, you're just going to await it like normal. I, for the most part, use try catch, but I it kind of makes me sad to use try catch because it adds that layer of indentation. It adds noise, and
your scope variables now are you have to do the thing you hate, which is create a variable above the block if you need to get something out of that.
I totally get why we have to do it, but I just the try catch really bums me out. As much as I love await and async await, having to really populate my code with a billion try catches, I think I'm using the promise.catch method while awaiting a promise as my default pretty much now. But yeah, for a long time, it's just try catch all over my code base. And every time I have to work in them, it kind of bums me out.
I am the same way. I will, in most cases, I will just await a promise and throw a catch on the end, which is, I call mix and match. It's because you're using the async await syntax, but you're also using the chainable promise syntax all in one go, which is totally allowed. One kind of cool thing I've seen some libraries do is they will return to you an object and you'll have your data and your error on that object. So you can await it or you could destruct, you can return an array and you could say like const square bracket data comma error equals await do your promise thing. And like that to me, that's ideal because up front you're getting your either your data or your error. And then the next line, you can check if you have an error or if you need to go ahead and do it. And that's doable in if you make your own function, but just it's not like if you're just using straight up promises, then
you but have if something to make a goes wrong, function. Then you still have to have a catch somewhere, you know, like if there's any like actually an error.
Yeah, you still have to have a catch somewhere because that's how async await and promises work in the browser. But if you create like a wrapper function, which I don't want to have to create a wrapper function every time I use it, but some libraries that do that, I kind of do like it. This is one that popped up the other day on Twitter where I checked if something was false and then returned false. Or I checked if something was falsy, and then returned false inside of a block. And I got a couple of people saying, why don't you, since it's a falsy value, why don't you just return the falsy value and convert it to a Boolean with wrapping it in Boolean or putting the two bangs in front of it? And like people were, there was like a 30 tweet thread of people just fighting about which one is better. And my answer to that is I had a console log in there inside the block. And I just deleted the console log, but I didn't turn it into the other way to do it. And I think that this kind of goes along with the implicit versus explicit return is if you need to now console log something in the case that that thing is falsy, then you have to change how you are doing it. So I don't know if there's, I don't have any rules here. I certainly love returning a false value, or sorry, a true or false in one go.
Yeah.
But there's nothing wrong with an if statement and then returning it. You know, like we're not always playing code golf here where the shortest is always the best.
I'm going to go ahead and say I agree with the gallery and all say right. that the return the Boolean is like how I always do it rather than doing any sort of if in there. Like, I can't say I never do it that way with a conditional, but I can't think that my brain ever goes to a conditional there.
Yeah, almost like it would be good to have like a ESLint fix for that, you know, where it's like, oh, well, all you're doing inside of this block is returning false. So then auto fix it versus having the block there.
Yeah.
So I don't think either one of those is big. I guess it is more explicit or to do the whole if block, but not as big of a deal in my opinion. These are some fresh coding practices, don't you think, Scott?
Yeah. I was gonna go with like if you need to create a fresh conditional or something. I don't know. Yours is probably better. Yeah.
A fresh variable.
Yeah.
So while we're creating fresh variables in our code, we're creating fresh invoices and fresh expenses in FreshBooks. FreshBooks is a cloud accounting software for your small business, and I use it myself. I've used it for probably 13 years now. I can look back all the way to the first invoice I have ever sent as a business, which is amazing. FreshBooks is really cool. You're going to want to check it out. 30-day free trial, no credit card required. FreshBooks.com/syntax.
Sick. All right. Last ones are all pretty benign, kind of like, just like coding style things, spaces versus tabs. I got to say tabs all day because they're not in the code. It's configurable by the editor. The editor can say a tab is actually this amount of distance or it's this amount of distance. And then if, you know, you want more space in there, you want actually like a bigger, wider space that doesn't involve actual code changes. So I'm a tab man. I'm drinking the tab.
A tab maniac. I've been on two spaces forever. The only reason I'm not using four spaces is because I need to be able to fit the space on the screen. But that's almost an argument for using tabs because you can adjust the size of your tab in your editor, right?
Yeah. Someday I'm feeling like four tabs and someday, or four tabs. Yeah. Someday I'm feeling like a four space distance and some days I'm feeling like a two space different distance. You never know.
You never know. So I've just been on two spaces forever. I think what is cool about that is now with tooling, it doesn't matter. You can let your editor show you how it is that you want. Same with like semicolons and whatnot. And then right before you commit, you could have a pre-commit hook that just formats it however your team would like it checked into the code base.
That to me feels too Rube Goldberg machine to me.
That's also true because like then like, are you really going to set up a pre-commit hook for every project? I'm big about the just get up and going.
And then the pre-commit hook fails and then you're debugging the pre-commit hook. Yeah. And then, yeah.
The one thing I don't like is still on GitHub, when you view code that has tabs are like a mile wide. Or if you like view source on something, which is less and less of an issue. But sometimes I still say like, oh my gosh, like fix this, please.
So that's something that I think really bothers me. I don't know why. Yeah.
Next one is trailing commas. And what a trailing comma is when you create an object. Let's say you have an object const person equals name is Wes. And then the next line you have age 100. After that age 100, do you put a comma after that, even though there is nothing underneath it? And the argument against it is JavaScript used to not let allow trailing commas. The argument
that was
for
an addition via ES6.
Yeah, it was awesome. Yeah. The argument for it is, if you want to add an additional property later on, you do not have to modify the code above it to make your line work because there's already a comma there. And same thing as if you want to delete something, you don't have to. And the annoying part is that JSON doesn't allow trailing commas, and it always trips me up. So I'm 100% team trailing comma. JSON 5, which is just it's a spec, I guess. VS Code uses it in all its configs, and it's amazing because you can have trailing commas and you can have comments and all of that stuff. So I am 100% team trailing comma.
Yep. TTC for me as well, team trailing comma all day. I will ride that train for sure. Yeah, I think the benefits are too big to not be there. And honestly, like you said, the JSON thing is the worst part about it, and it's not even related necessarily. So yeah, I would love trailing commas in JSON. Give me the trailing commas all day. I think at first I was like, what? Like I'm trying to put myself back in the ES5 days or whatever,
yeah,
and just be like, why would you want to do that? And then it's the type of thing you just configure your lint rules or your prettier rules to take care of for you. And then you just like never think about it ever again, because you can rearrange things. You can rework on whatever you're doing. And it just hashtag just works. Semicolons, I don't use them. I don't miss them. I haven't used them for like 3 years now or so. And I think there was like Kyle Matthews from Gatsby, like never use semicolons.
Yeah.
And he kind of opened me up to the idea of not using semicolons. And once I got rid of them, I just made that little prettier config change.
Yeah.
I have never once run into a situation where it has bit me in the butt. Never once.
Good.
Why? Because my editor can detect if that is a situation and it will add it in for me.
Robots.
So I do not even think about it. And I do not miss them. Sayonara, get out of here. It's just noise to me. I will die on that hill.
I use them, and I don't know why. I don't have a reason. I just like them. I add them.
Yeah.
I don't even like them. No, I don't like them. I don't not like them either. They're just there. I know where to put them. And or actually, you know, half the time I don't even write them. My prettier just puts them in for me. So I know that's such a heated thing, but I honestly don't have a fish in that pond. Or what's the horse in that race? I don't have a dog in that kennel.
Race, yeah.
I
gotta say, man, semicolons in CSS bum me out. That's like one of the biggest things.
Especially coming from stylists, you know? Remember
I know.
Us?
When I'm writing CSS, like 9 times out of 10, when I have like an error in my CSS, that's because I forgot a stupid semicolon and I hit save too early.
Yeah, that's a good point. I doubt we'll ever see that, you know, the CSS, because I look back at writing a bunch of stylus and I do not miss the indentation based syntax, but I do miss not having to do colons and semicolons.
Yeah, I might. This is very much me. But after this conversation, I might add a post CSS rule in here to get rid of semicolons, because you know what? I'm kind of sick of these semicolons. Get them out of my code base. Alrighty. Now's the part of the show where we talk about sick picks and shameless plugs, things that we think are cool, things that we think are neat, things that we think are just straight up sick. I am going to sick pick a podcast today. And you know me, I like podcasts. I listen to a lot of them. One podcast that I have really enjoyed, for those of you out there who are movie fans, Quentin Tarantino has a podcast called Video Archives that he does with Robert Avery, who's he's a pretty famous director. He's directed some like Rules of Attraction or some things that you might have heard of. But either way, they used to work together at a video store when they were both younger and before anyone knew who Quentin Tarantino was, right? So these guys have known each other for a long time. And what they do is they discuss 3 movies from that would have all existed in the video store that they worked at. And then they watch them on VHS or whatever type of thing that they're watching them on. Usually they're trying to get the same format or style in which they actually had in the video store. And then they just talk about them, whether it's like talking about Moonraker, which has honestly always been a favorite of mine, or getting into some really interesting movies. You really can't beat, there's whatever, I don't know how many episodes of the star, but you really can't beat the kind of expertise that you get from Quentin Tarantino and Robert Avery talking about just all kinds of films that you may or may not have heard of. And the fun part is I've heard of a lot of these movies. You know, they're getting into giallos or some like really kind of niche films that like I'm really into myself. So they're not talking about normal movies that you hear about, but just kind of interesting stuff. So it's called Video Archives, and there's 19 episodes that are public now. And I got to say, it's one of my favorites. I look forward to it every week.
Wow, awesome. I am going to sick pick a Wi-Fi access point. This is the Unify, I think it's called the U6. Let me just double check. No, it's not. It's called the Unify Access Point In-Wall HD. So our new house came with, like, the previous owners had it all wired up with Cat 5e, which is obviously not Cat 6, but it's fast enough for the internet speeds that we have. And we never could have that full potential of our gigabit down internet because it was all wasn't Wi-Fi 6. So I got these Wi-Fi 6 in-wall access points, and they're so cool because so basically you power it over PoE, it hooks up to a normal jack in the wall, like you just screw it into the faceplate screws, and in the bottom there's four LAN ports. Four LAN ports. So if you need to get hardwired somewhere, so our TV, I wanted our TV to be hardwired, but then I also wanted an access point there. So what I did is I wired in the access point. It gives us Wi-Fi 6 for all of our devices, but then you have now a little switch in the bottom, which you can power all of your devices directly from it. And these are awesome. It's really, really cool. I'm getting nice fast speeds off of our internet now. And we put two of them in the house along with some of our older Wi-Fi. What's Wi-Fi 5? What came before Wi-Fi 6?
I don't even know. Yeah. Wi-Fi 6 is the stuff that, let me tell you that.
You've had it for a while. I've not had any of it. I'm pretty excited about that.
Although I'm in a position now where I'm locked into this ecosystem and the new routers cost a lot and we need another mesh point. And I'm like, oh, I got to buy another mesh point. And, you know, however many of our devices actually can use Wi-Fi 6 is pretty limited. But those devices that do get that Wi-Fi 6, man, they are cruising. To get like 600 up and down on a phone, it's crazy.
It's pretty sweet. Yeah, so big fan of that. Check it on out. Shameless plugs, westboss.com/courses for a list of all of my courses. You can use the code Syntax for $10 off, or I have a whole bunch of free ones as well. You check those on out.
I'm going to shamelessly plug leveluptutorials.com. By the time you're listening to this, the redesign will have been out for about a month, which means that hopefully it is totally 100%, 0% bugs, 100% bug free. And just go and check it out. I've been adding some themes, Wes. Let me tell you. Our theming system has always been robust. I would say that's a specialty of mine, is like theming systems at this point. Yeah. And so, like, I built this site to be able to handle a theming system. And I started just casually adding some themes. And I added like a space theme that has like some little graphical stars in the background. And the colors are like this neon green and bright purple and black. And it looks so stinking cool. And I fall in love with these color schemes. I built one of the color schemes that's the same color palette as our current, the old website, the one that was up before. So if you like really like the old website's colors, you can use the old website's colors. It's just so much fun for me. So go ahead and check it out. Subscribe, become a subscriber, get access to a massive amount of video tutorials, a huge catalog, learn all the latest and greatest, including a new course on SvelteKit that is teaching you everything you possibly need to know. Level up. Oh, actually, we got a new URL too. Levelup.video.
Such a good URL.
Yeah, my fave.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll catch you on Friday.
Peace.
Peace.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.